Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today, I'm talking to Justin Gilligan. Justin is an incredibly talented nature photographer and has worked with Australian Geographic for over a decade. But he's also a marine biologist living and working on the south coast of New South Wales. We'll be talking about his passion for photography, how it all started, and how he ended up with a job we'd all consider a dream job. So I'm really excited to sit down with him on this episode of Talking Australia. Justin, thanks for hanging out with me today.
Thanks, Ange.
So we're going to be talking about a lot of things today, nature photography, marine science, but initially I wanted to ask you first off the bat, when was the first time you picked up a camera?
The first time, I think I was about 10 or 11 really, the first time just sort of topside where I sort of had an interest in photography and picked up a camera for the first time. But I was always interested in nature photography, even at that age. But underwater...
What sparked that interest?
Well, I think it was just magazines such as Australian Geographic and just that sort of long-form photojournalism where you could sort of spend time looking at sort of 12 or 15 pages, just sort of delving into a story. Yeah, so I just found that really interesting. But I didn't take my first underwater photo until I was about 14 or 15.
Right. And what was that of?
So I learned to dive in Port Stephens, and that's I was 14, and had a Nikonis 5 film camera. So back in those days, we had film. So that was this stuff that you put in the back of the camera, and you only had like 36 shots or 24. So you really had to think about what you were going to take and be conservative, and try and get the shot without actually having the ability to sort of look at what you were taking at the time. So it really helped to hone my skills. But Port Stephens, there was so much stuff to take photos of. Like it's lots of really good shore dives in the bay itself, and really currenty. So it's just this amazing invertebrate life, and then so many creatures that live within this sort of soft coral and sponge gardens. Like it was just like a wonderland.
And did your parents kind of encourage that interest?
Yeah, so both my parents did. And I ended up sort of learning to dive with my dad, and we went halves in the camera back in those days. And the plan was to split the film sort of 50-50. So he would take half and I would take half. And then as time went on, I would take more and more. And, yeah, but we had some really good times diving together. That was good.
Yeah. And does he do that often? Do you guys do that today? Like, do you still dive together?
So we don't dive that much together now, but Dad still does a lot of landscape photography and things like that. So we're always sort of out in national parks taking photos, but not so much diving together these days, but still travelling quite a bit.
Mm. And you're a marine scientist, correct?
That's it.
Yeah. So what came first, that love for marine life or photography?
So it was kind of, yeah, it's hard to tell what actually came first. It was a bit of a mix, I guess. So the photography sort of came first, and then through that there was like a strong interest in the marine environment and conservation issues. And yeah, I guess when it came to me finishing school and then going to uni, I had to make a decision whether it was going to be journalism or marine science, and I just made the decision to go down the marine science path at that stage.
And when you did make that decision, what were you kind of envisioning for your future? Were you like, okay, I will at one point figure out how I'll bring these together, or did you have something completely different in mind?
Well, I kind of was hoping to bring them together, and it was always, because they're so different, I always found it a little bit tricky. Like, there was the science side of things and then the photography kind of things. And even though they were linked, they were two very sort of different ways of thinking. But over time, as I sort of picked up jobs and stuff in marine science, I found the photography was really helpful to help tell the stories of the things that I was studying.
Right. So. Do you think these days it's realistic to just kind of finish high school, say someone like you who looked up to those Australian Geographic / Nat Geo photographers, do you think it's realistic to just go, I am going to be a photographer and just do photography? Or do you have to have kind of that backup or that combination of something?
I think it's really hard these days. And I think that, yeah, that combination is definitely important. So, like, whether it's having a specialisation in something else, whether it's zoology or marine science or something, that's kind of an advantage. But, yeah, you at least need to be able to sort of do photography, short videos, be able to put together web content as well as sort of long-form stories. So you definitely need that diversity these days to keep things ticking along.
And going back to your degree and what you studied, what was something that you specialised in, and I guess what do you do now in your job?
Yeah, so I guess the thing that I specialised in was Australian sort of temperate reefs, I guess. So I did a story for Australian Geographic, and it was focused on the Great Southern Reef. So from northern New South Wales all the way around southern Australia, Tasmania, up to Kalbarri on the west coast. And I guessed, yeah, just from growing up in Port Stephens, that falls within that footprint, that sort of has become the area where I sort of feel at home and where I sort of specialise, I guess.
Mm. So was it a situation where, I mean, in your work you were going out and doing that kind of research anyway, and then you would go, wait a second, that's a potential story, that's a potential story. Is that how it kind of worked?
It did, yeah. And the things that I was doing for work were kind of stories in themselves. So I'd be sort of doing the research side of things, but then spending more and more of my own time going back, trying to get the good conditions, trying to improve the shots sort of more and more. So they both kind of went hand in hand. And as I said before, for the research stuff, the photography stuff's been really helpful to try and convey those messages to a broader audience through presentations and the magazine articles and things like that.
Mm. And when it came to first getting published, how difficult was that, and where did you first get published?
Probably, yeah, the early stuff was with scuba diving magazines. So Sport Diver and Scuba Diver.
Are those Australian?
Yeah, Australian and sort of Asia Pacific, one of them. So it's sort of one's based sort of in Australia and the other one's sort of Australia and, yeah, Asia. And they were really the first magazines where I sort of put together stories and learnt to hone my skills to take a series of pictures that actually sort of told the story.
So would you agree that you kind of started out small?
Definitely started out small, and sort of one of those magazines had a sort of photojournalism competition. It was just a short story with some photos, and I ended up winning that competition. So that was, I was pretty young, and it was a really good boost and just sort of reinforced that, yeah, this is something that I really want to do. So I'm hopefully heading down the right track.
Mm. Now, I want to talk about your career with Australian Geographic. When did that first start? When did we first publish you?
I think it was 2009.
Oh, so a while ago.
Yeah, and so I had two double-page spreads on a story with that Valerie Taylor wrote. Oh. On sharks, yeah, dispelling some of the myths about sharks. So I'd pitched a story previous to that.
Well, that's actually a good question. How many times did you pitch before you got to that point?
Yeah, so I had pitched once, but it wasn't picked up. And then I think from that pitch, I met the editors and things like that. And
how did you meet the editors?
Oh, through the pitch.
Yeah.
So I reached out and sort of pitched the story I guess the story wasn't strong enough or relevant at the time, but maybe one or two of the pitches were recognised and then picked up for this other story that came out, I think it was a couple of months later. So it was pretty sort of lucky timing, really.
And what, I mean, from there, where did, I mean, go through like how that progressed into bigger stories and then eventually winning the nature competition.
Yeah, so I had been sort of, as I said before, doing stories for like different dive magazines. So I'd been doing it for quite a number of years leading up to it. I can't remember exactly at the time, but I probably would have pitched, I probably would have included some samples of the dive magazine work with the pitch. So I think that would have helped. But yeah, so after the Valerie Taylor story, I was going to Lord Howe Island with a group of colleagues to do some research, marine science stuff over there. And so I reached out to the editors, and because I'd had a couple of images published, I thought this would make a great story, and pitched it to them, and they were open to having a look at what I sort of brought back. So yeah, I just made sure I sort of worked quite hard, did all the research beforehand, and made the most of that story while I was there.
What do you think caught their eye about certain pitches, particularly the Lord Howe Island one? Probably because you were travelling there yourself, and
that's it.
It's an expensive trip.
Yeah, but I think it was that sort of specialist niche, sort of a different perspective. So it was shortly after that Valerie Taylor story. So it was 2009, and we were looking at the endemic fish species on the island, and so doing surveys, transects, counting the number of fish and where they occur. And one of the biggest threats was the McCulloch's clownfish. So the majority of this species population is within the Lord Howe Lagoon, and so threats from climate change and things like that, if they were to impact on one small area like the lagoon, that means this species could be lost. So it was kind of, that was the first story, and I think that Lord Howe's sort of been done a fair bit, I'd say, but because it was that different underwater twist that was kind of linked to an environmental or conservation story, I guess that was of interest enough to get the green light in the end. Once I'd bought that package of images back.
And would it be fair to say that the majority of your work with Australian Geographic is marine, is ocean based?
I think it is, yeah. And I think I have done stuff that's not just ocean based, but I think
it controversial to like dip your fingers in that pie and be like, oh guys, can I maybe do a story that isn't about the ocean?
Yeah, that's it. Well, I had to do a story, just a shoot for a day on a farmer's sort of market down off near where I live on the south coast of New South Wales, and that, like, even though it wasn't really linked to the marine science side of things, I found it really interesting just hanging out with those guys for a day and yeah, trying to tell their story through the images.
And what's been one of the best experiences you've had in doing underwater photography for Australian Geographic?
So probably one of the best ones was the Great Southern Reef story. And yeah, we're diving off Maria Island in Tasmania, and covering a research experiment by University of Tasmania researchers, and they had this big artificial reef kelp transplant experiment happening. And yeah, I was sort of covering that as part of this story, and yeah, this massive group of spider crabs came through the middle of the experiment, and that's when the octopus turned up, and that's when I ended up getting that overall winning shot for the competition.
Yeah, so that's the shot that won the nature photography competition in 2017. I want to talk about that shot, because how hard was it to get that image?
I think looking back, I think taking the shot wasn't too tricky, because I got quite a few shots that worked out well that day. But yeah, it was just sort of the timing is really hard to pick. So like that sort of encounter with those species like doesn't really happen that often at all. So it was quite a rare encounter that I just think it's an encounter that you can't really plan for.
We'll be back with our conversation with Justin Gilligan just after this. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. How do you kind of pitch stories to people that are so reliant on those moments that you can't plan?
So I think it's a bit of a blend. So you need to have a shot list that is achievable, but then sort of have a few things that are on the sort of, you know, this would be a dream thing if it happened. And then, yeah, on the other side of that, I guess things happen when you're in the field, because it's just like such a sort of rarely covered place and a rarely explored place, the ocean, that just things happen all the time. So if you're planning to go down and do one thing, something else might happen on the day. So you sort of need to be ready to be flexible to make the most of anything that happens.
Now, I want to talk about something that's kind of emerging in the field of natural history documentary making. And we know that David Attenborough has now done two documentaries, I think, now on that talk about climate change. So I'm curious about, nature photography used to be about beautiful places and things like that. But now it's almost like you have to bring in that conservation element. You have to talk about those things. Is that a change that you're sensing?
I think it's definitely a change, yeah, for sure. But there's still definitely a place for just beautiful nature photography. So just those moments in nature, whether it's in a rainforest or on a reef somewhere, that with just perfect conditions and it's just beautiful and like life is bustling, they're really important messages still to just show people how beautiful like places are right now. And then on the other flip side of that, there's that conservation sort of message that also needs to be told, because, yeah, we're threatening so many places. So, yeah, it's definitely important to show those beautiful moments, but also some of the impacts that we're having, just to make people aware of them.
And I think your experiences are quite unique in that you've been able to dive most of the coasts around Australia, most reefs, I don't know how else to say it, and you've been able to shoot them for Australian Geographic as well. So what kind of things have you seen in that area that, you know, are of concern?
Yeah, well, I do find our interaction with the marine environment probably the most interesting thing to cover. And because I've been diving for so long, I have, I have dived off Eagle Hawk Neck in Tasmania, for example, 10 or so years ago, and dived in healthy giant kelp forests down there. And it was, yeah, just amazing. These giant 30-metre beanstalks, and you can swim through them, and it's just this amazing sort of three-dimensional place, and the light filters through them, and yeah, it's just amazing. But since that time, there's no more kelp, no more giant kelp off that area of Australia. And so there's been like a 95% loss of that species of kelp along the east coast of Tasmania due to warming waters. And so that's one example. And I remember early days on the Great Barrier Reef, where it was just great expanses of healthy reef. And then I was up there in December, and there's still sections of healthy reef, but there's lots of sections that have been impacted by those recent sort of back-to-back bleaching events that, just sort of rubble. And or areas of dead coral, and some areas are starting to come back, but it's just going to take time. And if the events such as that sort of keep increasing, then yeah, there's just going to be greater impact on those World Heritage areas that we have in our own backyard.
And you've had the opportunity to dive around Sydney Harbour, and some of the images from that story were quite revealing and confronting. Can you talk a bit about those?
Yeah, so Sydney is an interesting one. So I think that it's just amazing that we have such an unbelievable marine environment next to our densest and biggest city. And I wanted to sort of explore that in a recent story for AG. And yeah, some of the diving within Sydney Harbour itself was just amazing. Like the diversity of marine life was just mind-blowing. And endemic species that are only found here, like weedy sea dragons and blue gropers and, yeah, really beautiful sponge gardens off the deeper reefs and clear water as well. Yeah, I just found it really inspiring. There's lots of conservationists as well doing things in their own backyard, like Operation Crayweed, working to restore sort of crayweed forests off the coast here that were threatened by coastal effluent that has since, it's now sort of cleaned better and it's pumped further offshore. But, yeah, but back in the 90s, some of those sewage outfalls had some, and 90s and prior to the 90s, just had some really impacts on coastal Sydney. But since that's sort of been dealt with, it's really improved the marine habitat off Sydney, which is great.
Mm. And for, I guess, the camera connoisseurs out there, what kind of camera gear do you use?
So I have I have a Nikon D810 at the moment, and I usually have two cameras and have one in a housing and one that I'll use for topside stuff. But, yeah, I use a Nauticam housing as well with Icolite strobes.
Nice. I don't know anything about that, but it sounds very technical. I wanted to go into the role of Instagram in nature photography and whether or not that's helped you or whether or not it's made the field more competitive. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I just think Instagram is a really, it's like a new platform, but it's a really important platform that people can use to sort of get their message out to a broader audience. And I think it's also good in that, you can see what other photographers are doing and sort of learn from what they're doing and look at other sort of areas or regions where you might plan to visit or, so you can sort of get an idea for what's being shot in a certain area. So you can sort of use it for sort of background research as well. But I think it's a really good tool, and I just think it's a great way for the photography community to come together and stay in contact.
Mm. And do you feel like there's more of a pressure for photographers to be in front of the camera as well and kind of have a sort of lifestyle around that photography?
Well, I think it is for sure with Instagram, and I think that like with the ability to tell stories and things like that within the Instagram platform, I think that people that are successful at Instagram are really good at sort of telling stories about themselves as well and showing themselves in the field as much as their own work. And I think that I guess that's a reflection of I don't know if it's being sort of on one side being business savvy and being aware of how to use the platform, but I guess on the other side it can be a reflection of different personalities. So some people, you know, love being sort of extrovert and being in front of the camera, and I think those people can really do a great job at being influencers by sort of showing an insight into their lives and the way they work. But, then on the other side, you've got sort of more introvert, quiet people that sort of are just showing their work and not getting into that showing behind the scenes as much. But, I just think that...
Where do you think you sit on that spectrum? I don't think I ever see photos of you on your Instagram.
I think I'm a bit more introvert, but I have been trying to sort of get into that more.
I love that you have to try to get into
it. Yeah, but... who knows, over time. I probably should. And, I just think it's important to show people how you're doing stuff as well and sharing some of your knowledge through that platform as well. So it's something that I'm going to have to work on in the future. And I take my hat off to all those influencers out there that are able to do that and that are doing a great job.
Yeah, and who do you follow on Instagram?
Quite a few people. So, of course, the AusGeo account and Nat Geo and, all the photographers that sort of post their images to those accounts. So, I think those two platforms really give you a nice snapshot of what's happening in those sort of two magazines. Yeah, I'm a member of the International League of Conservation Photographers, so it's definitely worthwhile checking out that account. And, within that account, there's a number of members that are worthwhile checking out as well, like Max Stone and Doug Gimshi and Thomas Peshak and, a whole range of photographers. So I'd sort of delve into those accounts and check them out. And I also find that it's a really useful tool to sort of for research. So you can sort of visit sort of Tourism New South Wales, visit New South Wales accounts or visit somewhere that specialises in northern Western Australia or the Kimberley, and you can sort of get an idea of what opportunities there are in those areas as well. So it's a really good research tool as well, I find.
Mm. Do you have people that, you mentioned that you read Nat Geo and Australian Geographic when you were quite young. Do you have mentors or people, maybe not mentors, but just people that you look up to and go, wow, like what an awesome career, and you kind of want to mirror that?
Yeah, for sure. There's especially those. Well, it was always the AusGeo photographers, and it still is. Like, they're just still quite amazing, but it's also like Nat Geo photographers as well. So, as I mentioned before, Tom Peshak, he's just amazing, and Paul Nickland and Brian Scarry and all those guys. So, it's just really good to be able to sort of keep on top of what those guys are doing and what everyone's doing, all the Australian Geographic photographers as well, and just sort of learn from their experience and the images they're taking.
Mm. And I wanted to go back to you winning the Nature Photography, the AusGeo Nature Photography Award in 2017. I noticed that, you've entered a lot of competitions. I was wondering what the role is of those photo competitions and whether there's opportunities for, I guess, underdogs to come through that way.
Oh, for sure, there is, yeah. And I think that, I think as many people as possible should sort of enter competitions because, you sort of become part of a friendly community, really. So you're all sort of competing and working against each other to try and be the best to tell stories of the natural world. And as you sort of enter competitions and as the years go by, you sort of push yourself. So you'll enter a competition and then you'll see what wins, and then you'll come up with your own ideas and sort of work to sort of push a bit harder for next year's entry. So I'd really see them as a positive thing to really help tell the story of sort of nature photographers all around Australia.
Mm. And how many times had you entered the AG competition before finally getting that in 2017?
Oh, I had been entering for like 9 years. So,
okay. I was hoping it would be a bit more hopeful than that, but all right.
No, but I had some success previously. So I won the portfolio prize a couple of times and had category wins and category runner up. And
because the winning image once, but you've been like in it for a while. Like, I always see your images in the word has literally escaped me.
The shortlist. So
I've seen your images in the shortlist a lot, like your shark image without the jaw. That's fantastic. It was incredible.
Yes.
Not because it was beautiful, but because it was catastrophic and it was such a powerful image.
Yeah. Thanks, Ange. But I just think they are, really important to enter those competitions, and it helps you sort of push yourself as a photographer. So I'd sort of been entering for 9 or 10 years now, so kind of getting into double figures now. But it's been great, and I encourage everyone to get involved and enter.
Yeah. Well, one question I'm curious about is you mentioned that you started out, kind of doing things with your dad. Did your dad kind of go, well, damn, right, now you've just gone off and done all your competitions? Is he like really proud?
I think so, but he's just enjoying doing his own thing as well. Like, he really enjoys sort of landscape photography and stuff, and it's still something that we can sort of share as well, which is great. And I'm sure he's proud, and we're still doing stuff together, which is great.
Are your parents the kind that like collect all your magazines?
They do a bit, yes. And my mum might have a number of prints on her wall
as well. I love that. And lastly, what advice would you have to people who kind of, are looking at your career going, wow, I want to be, an ocean photographer. I want to be published in Australian Geographic. What would be your advice to them?
I think just start with something in your own backyard, I think. So maybe not literally in your backyard, or maybe it is, but yeah, in the region where you live, so somewhere where you can sort of go back to that same place over and over and over and try and photograph that subject in different conditions, different light. And I also think that, try not to be cliche. So a lot of people sort of spend a lot of money, go to the Bahamas and photograph sharks at this one spot called Shark Beach. Mm. And I think, like, it's beautiful and it's clear and the subject matter's really interesting, but I think that there's a lot of pictures out there like that. So I think try and find something that's a little bit different, sort of near where you live, that you can sort of go back to and capture in different light or different, something doing unusual behaviour as well.
All right, perfect. Well, we'll end it on that note. Thank you so much for coming in to speak with me, Justin.
Thanks, Ange.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.